Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
And it is my great pleasure to introduce you, Kathy. Just a little bit about her if you don't know her yet. So she's been practicing and teaching bodywork and trauma recovery skills for 40 years. Her expertise is integrating touch into the practice of psychotherapy and trauma recovery, as well as applying somatic approaches to working with developmental and complex trauma. She is co-author of 3 books, including Nurturing Resilience, Helping Clients Move Forward from Developmental Trauma. So, Kathy, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and passion with us today. The stage is all yours now.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. It was nice to see Steve. He's a longtime colleague. He's on the faculty. He was on the faculty with the Somatic Experiencing Institute with me for many years. So welcome, everybody. So let's see. Let me give you a little bit of an overview of what we'll be doing, and then we'll just launch right in. So in this approach to how we're going to be working, one of the things we want to be looking at is that the skillfulness that supports us, the somatic skillfulness that supports us in differentiating between safety and threat, basically. And so we'll be talking about 3 primary systems in how we're approaching that. The first is interoception, which I'll talk about in a moment. Neuroception, which is that exact system that helps us differentiate between safety and threat. And the way that we create a referencing system, the way the brain creates a referencing system for us to compare new experiences to past experiences related to both safety and threat. So let's start with interoception. Interoception is the combination of the somatic experience that we use as referencing for our inner state. The whole concept of interoception has shifted over time, really dramatically, maybe in the last 10 years. We used to reference it only as being the inner experience, the inner the organs, the musculoskeletal system, the parts of the system that we could clearly say, these are internal sensations. And then we realized that was too simplistic because we have certain qualities such as the experience of pain, for example, that could be arising from within the body through inflammation or something like that. But we might have exactly the same sensation from something that's touching from the outside of our body. So we realized it was too simplistic to think that interoception was just interior experience. It also has to do with how we inform ourselves about our inner understanding of self and inner experience and our relationship to the outside world. So interoception now tends to be contrasted with exteroception, which is vision, hearing, sense of smell, the qualities that allow us to go to the outside world to gather information about the external environment. So anything we use to inform us about our inner experience is considered interoception. And primarily we're talking about the somatic systems, the organ systems and the skin, those kind of things. And we'll talk a little bit more in detail about that. The thing that we now know is that that system, what I call the interoceptive or somatic vocabulary, is developed in the context of our social group. It doesn't just automatically develop as a well-established and well-articulated system. We need feedback from the people around us to help calibrate our interoceptive understanding. So let's take as a really, really simple example, what's happening for the infant when they're hungry. in a very young infant, they're not going to understand that quality of sensation. They're just going to have an experience of some kind of distress because they're feeling hungry. And then if everything's going well, the caregiver responds to that cueing, feeds them, cuddles them, and the infant calms down. And now the infant begins to affiliate the sensation of hunger and the satisfaction of being fed and being nurtured with that quality. And then maybe as they mature and they develop language, the caregivers are even cueing them verbally. Oh, sweetie, are you hungry? Oh, here, would you like something to eat? And maybe even then it's getting more specific about preferences. What would you like to eat? There's things that you could eat that you're going to enjoy more than other things. And I'm hoping that makes sense, that we begin then, if we're having nice, healthy interactions with our care providers, we're beginning to develop a very nuanced, interoceptive, and somatic vocabulary. It requires that we are exposed to a wide range of experiences and that we have a quality of safety in the relationships and responsiveness in relationships that help us learn the meaning of these different sensations, these different qualities. So I have this experience of hunger. I don't really need to be distressed by it now. I can just know as I'm growing and getting more mature, oh, the remedy for that uncomfortable sensation is to have food. And then when I have food, I'll feel satisfied and I will be more calm. And that's happening across all different types of sensations. And we would think normally something like pain would be pretty clear from the beginning that pain is a bad thing. And so we are always going to react to pain with a distress response. But if we've been growing up in an environment where pain is affiliated with getting nurturing for whatever reason, maybe we're in a hospital setting and what we get is snuggled when there's going to be a painful procedure, we might actually start affiliating pain with something else that's positive. So our history and our experience of these different sensations builds that vocabulary over time. It's not a preset vocabulary. Certainly there's things that we already will be primed to respond to with distress, anything that's painful or uncomfortable. But even that might be altered depending how the people around us respond and how our environment does or does not give us an end to those qualities. So you take, for example, infants and children in an orphanage in a country where there's extreme poverty, there's not enough care providers in the orphanage. Perhaps the children have chronic infections or chronic pneumonia, which wouldn't be unusual in those environments. And there simply aren't enough caregivers to respond when there's distress. At a certain point, one of the things that we know will happen for infants and children in that environment is they will stop exhibiting the distress. No one has ever come. No one has ever really responded. So they don't make the connection between I have distress and someone comes and responds to it, and therefore I begin to feel safer. So that differentiation between threat and safety is starting very early. And the somatic vocabulary, the interoceptive vocabulary that we're developing that helps us understand those qualities is developing in that context of the social interactions. So we have, and we'll talk a little bit more later about what happens in terms of that referencing system and our memory, but we're developing, even before we have language, verbal language, we're developing a somatic language to help us understand our somatic, our experience of our internal environment and our external environment and the interrelationship between them. That's how interoception starts us on that path and that differentiation. The other thing that's happening simultaneously with that, again, if everything is going well, is our caregivers are helping us make some of these differentiations. And one of the main ones that's relevant for what we're talking about here is the differentiation between threat and excitation. And that's a very critical one in the context of trauma. Especially if we have early trauma, we may not have learned to differentiate when we're enjoying something and having, for example, active play, where our physiology would be actually in the same basic state it would be in threat. Our heart rate would be up. We're secreting chemicals that increase our circulation and bring lots of blood flow to our muscles. All of the same things that would be happening if we're in the fight or flight survival response. But because they're happening in the context of safety in relationship, it equals active play. It's something pleasurable. It's exciting, but it's safe and it's pleasurable. And probably all of us have either experienced or witnessed that process where it was exciting, it was exciting, it was safe, and then now it's not. And the child gets past their threshold of feeling like this is fun, and then you hear that distress scream come in. And again, if everything's going well, the care provider responds and soothes, maybe apologizes, oh, sweetie, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to frighten you. And it's those kind of interactions that help the child learn from really early infancy. Oh, there's things that bring that heart rate up, that physiological response that are enjoyable, that are exciting, and they aren't the same as things that are threatening. And that our caregivers' response to us in response to the environment helps us do that differentiation of excitation versus threat. And of course, it's not always going to be 100% clear because sometimes things start out seeming like they're exciting and then they become dangerous. So it's not to say it's a perfect system, but that's one of the things that we're learning is this differentiation of how we know when we pass that threshold that it's no longer just exciting, it's become frightening. The safety element goes away. So that's the first piece with interoception, is that learning our own somatic vocabulary. Then there is this concept of neuroception. That word actually was coined by Stephen Porges. Many of you know Steve is talking at this conference. So many of you will have experienced his written material or attended conferences with him or workshops. So that the word neuroception is a term that he coined to give a kind of a nuanced understanding of how this interplay between interoception and the relational qualities of safety and our perception of the external environment combine to allow that somatic ability to differentiate between people and circumstances and things that are safe versus things that are threatening or dangerous. That process is called neuroception. And what happens in that is that we take this information from our interoceptive vocabulary, our inner experience, and that referencing system has been developing over time. And of course, when we're very young, in theory, our care providers are being the protectors of us. So primarily, they're the ones that make the decision about what is safe and what is threatening. And then if it's threatening, they move to protect us. But as we mature, and we're able to be out in the world more, we can walk, we can run, we can open doors, we can move out into the world, we have more social skills, we can be slightly independent at least to go out to meet other people. There's a greater demand for more nuance in our ability to differentiate between people and places that are safe or threatening. So we have to have a maturation process of these systems. So we now start to take that early learning of interoception, combine it with our observations, the exteroception of the external world. What are the sights and the sounds and the smells of things that are unsafe? The smell of smoke, maybe that makes me more cautious because it's become affiliated with something that could hurt me. So what are the odors? What are the sounds? What are the movements that I might see? And combining that with what sensations I might have, I am making a more nuanced assessment of my inner and outer environment to make these differentiations of safety versus threat. And then added to that is all the social cueing that's happening. With infants and small children, there's some things that they don't know in advance whether they're safe or unsafe. It takes the cueing of the social group. Oh, don't touch that. You could burn yourself. Don't do that thing. Don't run into the street. Whatever the cueing is from our care providers that communicate to us socially, oh, this is the thing that is affiliated with threat, and this is the thing that's more affiliated with safety. So we get this feedback from multiple systems, and that's neuroception. That's the whole, complex system that includes our physiology, all these different physical systems, our perception of the external environment, and the social cueing and the social interactions all together provide this support for this system called neuroception that helps us do this kind of foundational differentiation between safety and threat, very deeply somatically and socially based. I'm hoping that's making sense so far. In a few minutes, I'll talk about what happens in terms of the memory and how we create a referencing system that does a kind of a shortcut that even bypasses some of our learning about this differentiation. But before we do that, what I'd like to do is just a really simple exercise so that you get a feel for some of this cueing that could be happening that maybe is even in the background for you. A lot of this happens almost at a subliminal level. It's meant to be a language that we can rely on, that we don't have to assess every unique situation for safety versus threat. And that's what I'll talk about next, is how we categorize it. But a lot of this is really meant to be in the background. We're not, for the most part, consciously thinking about it unless it's a new experience. So many of these things are kind of set when we're very young, and then we don't come back in and ask somatic and bring a somatic inquiry, for example, to say, is that an accurate perception of those qualities, those inner sensations? So I'd like to just guide you through a very brief exercise. This is one of the ones that it actually could become a bit of a daily practice, and it's one of the ones that I might give to clients for them to do on a regular basis so that they begin to ask some questions about their understanding of the neuroceptive system, but also the interoceptive system and the meaning that is being made for them within them from these accumulated experiences about safety versus threat. So the prompt or the question that I would give you is, when is the last time you felt safe? Just put your attention back. It could be right now. And I'm aware as I ask that question, that is what's true for some of you is the answer to that question is, I don't know if I've ever felt safe. I'm not sure if I've ever felt that. I think I might have. Or maybe you can think of a time, months or years ago, a single time, and it stands out for you because it's so unique to feel safe. If that's true for you, then what I'd like you to consider is imagine what it would be like to feel safe. And for that to be true often enough that you have an easy way to find that experience. So for those of you who have a more reliable sense of access to safety, just remembering a time you felt safe. And for those of you where that access has been less reliable, imagining what it would be like to easily find a time to feel safe. And as you do that, I'd invite you to notice what happens in your body, particularly what happens with your breath. What happens with the way that your muscles are behaving? Are they still exerting what I call anti-gravity effort? Slightly braced, slightly lifting your weight off the surface that you're resting on. And if that's the case, is there a way for you to breathe and allow your weight to come to rest? One of the very important body cues for when we are feeling safe is when we let our full body weight come to rest, that we're not already started in responsiveness, that we're able to really let ourselves fully stop. And very often that's affiliated with a broadening and a widening of the breath. And if you're not feeling that, notice what you are feeling. For some of us, a feeling of safety has to do with allowing our heads to move gently, that we're no longer having to so heavily control the weight of our head. For others of us, it might be that we start to feel the surface of our body again when we haven't been feeling it. Or we might notice what's in the room more than we did otherwise. So just notice what these cues are for you that you affiliate with safety. So in working with clients, this is sometimes where we have to start. For those of us who are clinicians, who are practitioners, sometimes we're assuming the interoceptive system and the neuroceptive system have developed with this ready access to safety. And what's true in the face of trauma, particularly early trauma, is sometimes these systems didn't have the opportunity to develop so that a felt sense of safety was available to us. What might be more true for us is that we have a very well-developed threat map. The way I put it is you have a really well-developed danger map. You have a lot of somatic vocabulary for things that could be a problem, things that are wrong, things that are worrisome, sensations that might mean something bad is going to happen. That's the other thing that happens with interoception that I haven't talked about, is it's predictive. One of the things we learn in that learning of interoception is, what do these sensations mean for my future? So one of the most common ones that all of us will experience to some degree is that I have to go to the toilet. I perhaps have the sensation of a full bladder, whatever my qualities are, that I'm going to need to have to go to the toilet. So I might even be relatively accurate in predicting when that's going to happen. Another one might be, am I coming down with a cold or am I just tired? They're similar sensations and I don't know yet which of those things is happening. Time has to pass a little bit for me to say, oh, I think actually I'm getting a cold. If I were tired, I would be after a night of sleep feeling better than this. So we use interoception to predict what's going to happen in the future. So if your interoceptive vocabulary is a little bit more inclined towards worry, your predictions for the future will be a little more inclined towards worry. That's what I want to talk about next. And then we'll do another little exercise and hopefully we'll have time for questions at the end. So this referencing system that I'm talking about, a prediction for the future, is actually partly done by the way our brain functions. And this is another thing that's important for us to know, both when we're doing work for ourselves, but when we're also when we're working with our client population. And this, I'll just say up front, this is an oversimplification of what happens. It's the basic system, but I'm going to make it really simple. So we have these two structures, three really, because there's two of the amygdala, which just is a little almond shape. That's what that word means, almond-like, almond form. We have an amygdala on each side in our brain, deep in the brain. And the amygdala has many different functions, but one of the functions of the amygdala is to help in a certain kind of learning so that we accumulate information that we don't have to meet every new experience as completely unique. The amygdala, one of the things the amygdala will do is give a kind of a tagging, labeling for the hippocampus to say, this thing that just happened is really important, so remember it. And that'll be for things that are really important in a way that we would consider positive. I was excited, I was happy, I had a really good time. I'm gonna remember this because it gets tagged. The amygdala says, this is very relevant for future reference. You really, really, really like the flavor of raspberries. You so enjoyed that. Remember that you like raspberries, or you had that really great experience at that whatever fair or whatever you went to. Likewise, on the other side, if it was something very frightening, very devastating, we're going to get this tag. The amygdala says, this was important. Remember it for future reference. And this is one of the reasons why we might have been having the same experience as someone else, but we remember really different things. So you had some childhood experience with a sibling, and they remember it as the worst day that they had the whole year, and you remember it as the most fun you had. Or maybe you don't remember it at all, and they have this big, huge story about how awful that day was, and you can't remember anything about the day. Well, you filed it differently. And that's kind of how the system works, is the amygdala is basically saying to the hippocampus, we need a big file cabinet here so that we can store a bunch of these past experiences to have quick reference. And the classic example that's used with the amygdala is that a snake or a stick? When I encounter something that could be one thing or another, it's one, this is very similar to the other thing. The amygdala has been accumulating over time all these different versions of categorization. That's a threat, that's a threat, that's a threat. That's safe, that's nice, that's something pleasant. So in theory, if you're having a wide range of experiences, your file cabinet has a mix of these different types of experiences. Safety, 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 oh, here's a threat. Safety, 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 here's a threat, right? It's a stick, it's a stick, it's a stick. Or maybe it's a candy, or it's a, you know, something pleasant. And then there's an occasional snake. If everything's going really well in your environment, there'll be an occasional snake that says, ah, I have to have a different reaction to it. And then when you encounter something that is similar, that's in the same category, it's like you're doing this quick reference, looking through your files. Is there anything like this from my past? And then it gets pre-categorized. That's one of the jobs of the amygdala, is to sort for relevance or salience. Is it something that is relevant to me? It's innocuous, it's neutral, I don't have to pay attention to it. And all of these introceptive and neuroceptive experiences are contributing to that file cabinet. So that by the time we are into adulthood, we have this huge referencing system that quickly causes us to categorize, to pre-categorize different types of experiences. And what will not happen then is when we have a novel experience is we won't have a file for it already. So we have to create a new one for this new unique experience. But if we take the example of someone who's had early trauma or lived in a culture where they are constantly made other and are responded to in a way that gives an experience of threat. We can imagine for someone like that, the file cabinet has mostly threat information in it. And the way I put it to clients is you're living in a world that's full of snakes. In terms of what your day-to-day experience was, the majority of things you encountered were things that felt threatening to you. Maybe they weren't actually, but by the time you're 6 or 7 years old, you already have a lot of accumulated experience about the internal and external environment. If you've been in the hospital environment, for example, your family may not have any stories about trauma, but you may have had these exposures of being isolated and having procedures that were painful. And if it was a long hospitalization, you perhaps have a really big file about things that are dangerous, that are affiliated with the smells of the hospital or the sounds of the hospital, or the appearance of people that have a type of uniform on or something like that. You now have this file that says anything in that category is going to feel threatening to me. The people around you may not understand why you're responding that way, but your filing system has said, this is important, remember it. And it's important in the threatening side of things, not in the safety side. So then when you encounter that novel experience, if you're doing your referencing to say, is this something dangerous or is this something safe? You're going to encounter a huge percentage of comparative information that says the most likely thing is this is going to be a threat. So respond accordingly, just in case it's a snake. So even new experiences are more likely to be categorized over into the threat side. And then that consolidates our inner referencing system. I felt this way inside when I had that experience. And so now when I'm having anything similar to it, I go inside, and we have this myth that says the body never lies. Well, it doesn't mean the body's always accurate, put it that way. So in this case, I go inside, and the example I use for people is a panic attack. There you are having a panic attack. There's nothing actually objectively dangerous in the environment. But if you go inside to check your own somatic system to say, is there something threatening? Your somatic system is going to say absolutely yes. Because if there was nothing threatening, my heart rate wouldn't be so high, my breathing wouldn't be like this, my muscles wouldn't be ready to run, I wouldn't be feeling like I'm about to die and something horrible is going to happen. And so then that internal referencing system creates yet another file that says, see, I told you this was dangerous. I knew you shouldn't have done this thing, because now we have yet another thing that says a bad something happened. And then that file cabinet gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I hope it's starting to make sense. So let me give you just a little piece on this, and we'll do another exercise and we'll have some questions. So here's the thing about this system. Depending what age we are, that system has been happening for a lot of years. If you're working with children, maybe it's 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. If you're working with adults, many of the clients I worked with were older adults, so in their 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s. That's a lot of years of filling up your file cabinet with references that are mostly about threat. So as a practitioner, if I'm inviting you to notice your somatic systems and gather information, mostly the vocabulary you have is a very well-developed vocabulary about threat. That's been kind of a necessary side effect of the experience of your life. So if we don't work to create a bigger, wider referencing system that includes experiences of safety, or includes even the possibility that something new is just neutral. It's just a new thing. It doesn't inherently mean that it's bad. Because for some of us, if it's new, it's going to hurt me. That's my experience, is that if I don't know what it is, the likely thing is it's something that's going to hurt me. So now I've again categorized it over there. If I can't find neutral or positive, then there isn't going to be a way to change that referencing system. But here's the problem with it that we will all encounter, both when we're doing this work ourselves and when we're working with clients. The associated experiences that are tagged most quickly for our memory are the big ones. They're the things that scared us half to death, or they're the things that we enjoyed so intensely that the amygdala said, absolutely remember this one. You can go back 20 years from now and you will remember it because it had such an impact on you. The chances that we're going to be able to give ourselves those experiences on a daily basis is actually pretty small. So what that means, both individually and then as a clinician working with clients, we just have to work on volume. This is why a daily practice sometimes is necessary. The only way to create more files for the safety and the neutral side is to have that many more experiences, so that eventually the brain says, oh, I guess we better remember this because it's happening every single day. And we just accumulate enough of it to say, oh, now I'm getting it. This is the experience of safety. This is what this thing is. This is what it feels like when I like something. And we accumulate enough of the referencing system that when I have a new experience, I don't automatically put it over as possibly threat. I'm at least willing to have a few moments or days or whatever to consider, this might actually not be anything. This might be actually unimportant and I don't have to respond to it. Or it's neutral, it turns out I don't really like it. That's one of the things that's happening in our early development. Our caregivers are helping us recognize just because we don't like something, it doesn't mean it's dangerous. If we're sharing food together and they like something that I don't like, they'll help us understand, oh, you don't like that. I like that. You don't like that. Doesn't mean it's going to hurt you just because you don't like it. I hope that's also making sense. For many of us, if we have a lot of history of experience of threat, we can't take the risk when we don't like something of sticking with it until we know for sure if it's safe or dangerous. We're going to default to threat right away. So for many of us, the way we figure out, oh, something's threatening is, I don't like it. That's our criteria that we're using is, I don't like it, therefore it must be threatening. So what we're trying to create are other references that say, I don't like it, and then I don't have to do it or taste it or experience it anymore, but I don't have to react to it as a threat. Okay, so I'd like to do one more exercise. This is one that's fairly relevant to current circumstances. It's one I use as a daily practice. It's one that I give to clients as a daily practice. It's simple, you can do it anywhere. And then after this, we'll open things up for questions. This one, I use two different names. Some of you who have done other programs with me will have experienced it because I use it a lot. I call it either objecting without contracting or letting it be so. And the names are different only because when I'm helping a client figure out how to do this, I'm relating it to the specific thing that's happening for them. Many of the people in the client populations I've worked with have chronic illnesses, or maybe even they have a terminal diagnosis. So letting it be so is a name that matches a little bit better, that you have something that you really don't want it to be true. And yet it is, and probably there's not that much to do about the thing itself. What you have to do is your relationship to it. So the term letting it be so fits with that a little bit more. Objecting without contracting is when there's something happening and it's somewhat out of your control, and perhaps you are bringing a lot of effort into the objection and perhaps taking a lot of action, but it might even be something that's harming you. You're doing that to the point that you're neglecting yourself and your health or your loved ones, or you're doing things that are actually dangerous for you. And you can't stop yourself from doing that because you must respond. So then it's, how do you object and hold objections and take action, but to do it in such a way that you don't harm yourself? That's the idea behind it. So again, I'll just lead you through the exercise, letting yourself be as comfortable as you can, wherever you are sitting or standing or lying down. And consider something, and right now in the world, there's an awful lot of these somethings that you're objecting to that you don't want to be true. The current one that I've been working with almost every day is the amount of suffering that's happening now globally in so many different ways. And I object strenuously to that. So my invitation to you is being aware of what happens when you don't want something to be so, that you are objecting with every ounce of your being. And you breathe and you let yourself feel the things I invited you to feel that are affiliated with the experience of safety for you. For most of us, that means allowing our breath to open, allowing our weight to rest down, inviting ourselves to be present to ourselves, to feel ourselves, to not leave ourselves out as we are moved to take action, as we are moved to state a necessary objection, as we are moved to notice that we really do not want something to be true. And we can still be present to ourselves and breathe and find safety within ourselves as best we can. For some of us, it's only going to be a respite. For some of us, the world still is actually dangerous for us when we're out in it. And in some cases, we need to be prepared to respond to that. But we also need at least some moments of respite. We need to be building that referencing system that says, this is how I know I'm safe. This is how I know I'm with myself. And I can be with others with whom I am safe. This is what it feels like to have that experience. And that in no way diminishes your ability to object or to wish that things are not true. They can both be present. You don't have to constrict and contract in order to strengthen your objection. You can object and breathe. You can object and be present to yourself. You can object and perhaps even open your heart and find compassion as you object, compassion for yourself and compassion for others. And so just taking a few moments to notice that it might not feel the same as when you recalled the experiences of safety or imagined the experiences of safety. In fact, what we want is a broad range of experience of things that feel pleasurable and safe. Ideally, what we have is a very nuanced vocabulary for things we enjoy and for experiences of safety, including that quality of safety with excitation. For some of us, as soon as we start feeling that quality of excitation, it's frightening. So if we can strengthen our capacity to notice safety, that also tends to strengthen our capacity to support excitation while also feeling safe, and also to support excitation and safety for others. That's particularly important when we're objecting. For us, if objection comes as a quality of aggression, sometimes that limits the other person's ability to take us in and hear our message. So if we can cultivate those qualities in ourselves of experiencing safety in this broadening and opening and strengthening and opening of our heart, as we also bring objection, sometimes that facilitates necessary communication and necessary change. That's a lot of what this conference, this part of the conference is about, is supporting social change, healing from trauma and supporting social change. If they happen together, it's fabulous, in my opinion. So I'm hoping that's useful. And I'm assuming perhaps it's provoked some questions and we actually have time. I'm right on time. I can't believe it. I'm actually a couple minutes early. So if we have questions that people have been sending in, that would be fabulous.
Yeah, you have done brilliantly, Kathy. Thank you so much. And such an insightful discussion so far. I saw already a couple of people saying they will need to rewatch it just to process the information again at their own time.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a data dump.
Very, very helpful. Thank you. So let's start with the first question from Jose. That's the highest rank currently. And please, in the meantime, keep voting and keep adding your questions so that we know which ones to pick next. So can you talk about the difference between a gut feeling or intuition versus a survival response, making up a story to pull you closer or away from a situation?
Well, so the idea of a gut feeling is actually what we would call interoception. And the thing that I am always saying to clients as we're talking about this is, all of that's really fabulous if you are a reliable witness to your own experience. So if your gut feeling is more cued over to filtering for threat, it's not all that reliable. So I'm interested in the reliability of it, because then that will inform the survival response. That's one of the things that should be happening. If everything is going well, you will develop a reliable informational system, self-informational system, so that you can trust your gut feelings. One of the things that's so difficult for people who have panic attacks is they can't trust their feeling of danger. So now you're in a position of reacting to everything as if it's dangerous, even when you think maybe you're just having a panic attack. But because it could be that you're accurately perceiving the environment, you're kind of left with going with those feelings or figuring out a way to kind of talk yourself out of it. So what I'm interested in, and this is a language that Stephen Porges uses, he talks about these as neurophysiological platforms that support different categories of behavior. So the neurophysiology that says I'm safe, or this referencing system that says I'm safe or dangerous, is just there to inform the behavioral systems. So what do I do about that when I feel that? So then your gut feeling, that kind of referencing system, if everything is going well, is reliable to support the survival response. And what you will end up with then is congruence between your survival response and what your interoceptive system is telling you is happening at this moment and what is the appropriate response. So I want this system recalibrated. That's the language I use with clients. We need to recalibrate so you can have different categories of self-conversation. If the only conversation you have with yourself is we're all going to die, then you're reacting all the time with big survival response, even when it's not necessary. And it's depleting for the system, and it just fills that file cabinet with more threat references. So I'm hoping that got a little bit to the question. That's how I work with it in terms of the work that I'm doing, is I want that gut instinct to be accurately informing survival response.
Yeah, thank you so much. Cool. And I'm building on that, maybe you mentioned panic attacks. So there is one, and still it's about the gut-mind connection. So somebody's saying that her panic attacks include bowel movement, and a couple of times she lost control over them.
Right.
Any advice or anything you can share maybe shortly about the gut-mind connection?
Well, and this is exactly the same thing, is we need to be able to interrupt that very extreme physiological conversation that's happening. It's not unusual to lose control of your bowel. And as far as your body knows, you're in an extreme threat. That's what the physiology is telling you in a panic attack. Something really dangerous is happening. And voiding the bowel is one of the physiological responses that we have. If we were appropriately responding to threat, we'd be like, great, good job, you can run faster. It's because it's happening in a circumstance where it doesn't match the circumstance. So that's where we want some recalibration, so that you can start having these other kind of conversations and also developing tools to interrupt that cascade that gets started. As, okay, I can feel where we're going now. We've got some tools to interrupt that and slow this down and bring in another conversation with ourselves. And those little exercises I did are just the beginning of having someone being able to do that. So I can work with my breath, I can come present to myself, I can settle in my system, I can send all these cues back to the autonomic nervous system that says, actually, everything's fine. No need to get quite so panicked, because we're doing better than we thought. And we expect that to take time. If you have a lifetime of this system running amok, so to speak, it's going to take time. So also be kind with yourself when it's taking time to make the changes, so that your body isn't picking you up and moving you sort of outside of your conscious ability to control it.
Yeah, I really like this point around validating ourselves. You know, it's very natural that we want to get over and done with, you know, any of these symptoms that we are experiencing, and we try to rush into solutions, but it does take time. So I think it's an important message to remember.
Yeah.
Okay, so there have been a couple of questions around parenting, so I'm trying to group these together into actually the impact of parenting. And some folks are mentioning, you know, what if, you know, your parent is depressed or a very anxious person, or actually a very violent and angry person, you know, what might be the impact? And I think if we can connect it with, the recent, COVID, situation where I think depression, anxiety is on the rise, sense of safety, even for kids, is much more at risk. So what is it that we can do to minimize the impact?
So the very first, most basic thing to know is some is better than none. So we know that the circumstances make it very difficult for us to feel safe if we're the parents or we're the teachers or we're whoever is providing care for children. But what we know in the research and what we know in just being with children is any amount of safety that you can give a sense of is better than zero. So maybe now we can't do 100%. Maybe we're way down there around 10% because we ourselves are at risk. We have food insecurity and job insecurity. Maybe our own survival feels at threat. But if we can make times in the day, if we can have conversations, depending on how old the child is, about the circumstances. And one of the things that Steve Porges has said that really stays with me is he talks about interoception as the infant and the child's sixth sense. If you can't regulate your heart, if you can't know when you're hungry and need food, you're at risk. And yet as a culture, as a dominant, the dominant culture, I'm speaking from North America, some of you are from places where this won't be accurate, but in North America, we do almost nothing to increase children's interoceptive competency. We teach them lots of social skills. We do all sorts of stuff to socialize them. And yet we don't really overtly assist them in learning their own body information. So one of the things we can do together is a version of these exercises. Even though my colleague that co-wrote Nurturing Resilience Together specializes in working with children. And he talks about it as this quality of even though. Even though there's all these scary things happening out in the world, we're here together. And together we can find our breath. And together we can notice our food that we're taking. Together we can notice our connection. So any of that that we can do, we are laying down those neural pathways for the child to have greater access to that signaling as we make our way through these challenging times. So if you're a teacher, 5 minutes, 10 minutes with the kids doing that is better than none. If you're the caregiver in any other way, any amount of time that you spend doing that, especially if it can be on almost a daily basis, you are starting to lay down that neurochemical architecture for the child to have access to that felt sense of safety when the external environment is more congruent with it being true. So we're trying to support their internal environmental access to that sense of safety while the external world is starting to hopefully catch up with us. I hope that makes sense, but we absolutely know that. It's more hopeful than it sounds. We just need to do some of it and do it, don't do it once a week. Any little bit that you can do and any reprieve from violence, any reprieve from feeling out of control is gonna be helpful for children of any age, even those of us who are, in double digit ages farther along at the spectrum, that feels good for us.
Thank you so much, Kathy. And then even though we are at time, maybe just two very quick questions. So I actually wanted to jump on another generation. So not kids, but rather grandparents. We have a question around someone's mom, I think from Cornelia. She's 75 years old and she feels she could use some of these techniques. So just shortly, is there a chance for a person at that age to change something?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My 94-year-old mother is doing this stuff with me. We do crossword puzzles together on Zoom too, but that helps. So many of the clients that I've worked with are in those older age categories. And I've had clients in their 70s and 80s say they feel like they have more health than when they were in their 20s and 30s because they're healing those early wounds and they have better access to this sense of regulation and presence with themselves. So never too late. Have at it.
Thank you so much. And I know there are a lot of people would like to obviously learn more and as much as possible, practical applications. So we do have your website that we post here. Is there anything in particular as a resource that you would like to highlight that folks can tap into?
Well, the other book that I co-wrote with a colleague around these touch practices is The Tao of Trauma with Elaine Duncan. And that has some of these specific practices that they're in the context of using touch, but they can be adapted to be used in this way. And then Nurturing Resilience, as you already talked about, has a lot of this information about the physiology and the threat system, so we have a better understanding. So those are the additional resources that could be helpful.
Thank you so much, Kathy. And in a moment, I will come back to you for the last question, but a little bit of logistics then until... hope you've been enjoying this discussion. I mean, based on the comments, everybody's really at Kathy. So if you would like to continue the discussion, you have two options. So you can go on our Facebook site and then keep posting, sharing your experience and questions. Or you can join one of the coffee breaks from the portal itself and then meet like-minded people who would like to talk about the same topics as you. Also, if you can, I do recommend you purchase the recording, so get the full library so that you can get access to all of this wisdom and knowledge that is being shared in these 1.5 weeks for your lifetime, so you can digest it at your own time. So some of you already mentioned you would like to listen back to this session, which obviously you can do for the next 48 hours on the portal or on Facebook, but after that it won't be available unless you have the full access. So again, if you have the means, please do purchase the package. It also helps this being made available for free right now for everyone. There are some special offers for those of you who are working with trauma survivors or doing generally trauma work. So do check out the special offer. You can also send an email to the Embodiment Conference to check those details out, so you can get either 50% or 100% off, depending on the situation. And then, Kathy, again, back to you. So the last question, what is your top tip to stay embodied?
Well, in these times, it really would be about self-care. I know many of the people who are attending are supporting other people. They are therapists themselves, they're family members. And in that, we can deplete ourselves and lose relationship with ourselves. So making sure that we are taking care of ourselves and doing that necessary self-care in these particular times, I think, is one of the ways then we move back into relationship with ourselves and notice what our needs are as we are serving the needs of other people, so that we really have a deep pool to use to continue that healing work that many of us are engaged in.
It's beautiful. Thank you so much, Kathy, again, and thanks for all of you for tuning in. I hope you will have a beautiful day ahead and see you soon in our next sessions. Take good care.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Great to see all the names. I read all the ones I could. Bye.